if you hit the link to the maps on the left-hand side, the little plus button. No, a little further down.
Very bottom one. Yeah. There you go.
And click on the little plus sign on the left. There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. This is. I know that this is given this whole area is given a lot of people heartburn. I think in trying to figure out how to address this. We are now in a court. If I understand the staff recommendation, please correct me. Anything I may say here. That the purple zone, the residential development area, is now eliminated from. Or you're recommending that it be eliminated. About 200 acres of will be retained, but still is essentially adjacent to the other areas, more adjacent to the other areas. Now, I'm particularly pleased to see this happen because this is, as we know from the testimony in the record, there is some very sensitive habitat here, not the least of which is the habitat associated with Canada Lynx. By removing this from development, we approach the Canada Lynx question by avoidance of impact as opposed to proposing some kind of mitigation, either through the easement or some other means of mitigation for incursion into the Canada Lynx habitat. Now, I know for a substantial period of time, the state of Maine was in legal conflict with the federal government regarding whether or not Canada Lynx should be listed or listed in the state of Maine as a threatened and endangered species. If so, under federal approach to regulating this kind of habitat, avoidance is the only mitigation. The state has argued that because we may have substantial Canada Lynx habitat and it may adversely affect other types of activities, that we should be allowed not only mitigation through avoidance, but mitigation through off-site mitigation, such as setting aside other land or preserving other types of habitat, off-site mitigation. It seems to me that the suit filed by the state of Maine and its resolution by the courts makes us, at least in theory, subject to the federal requirements. Therefore, the only approach to mitigation is avoidance. If we were to allow for development in this area and argue that it can be developed because off-site mitigation can minimize the impact to this habitat, we would be subject to litigation, perhaps ongoing litigation for some period of time, and the developer would be also subject to that litigation. It just seems to me that avoiding impact on the Canada Lynx habitat makes a lot of sense for the lynx, for the habitat, for the people of Greenville, and for, I think, all of us involved. So I'm very much pleased with the elimination of that. Now, as for the zones that are to remain, again, I'm very concerned about development in this area, as I'm sure other people are as well. And I'm convinced, again, that the adjacency comes into play here, in that these zones that will remain, with the exception of the Lily Bay Resort development area that is up in the boonies there, that development could occur here as a result, absent the concept plan. The amount of development that's being proposed here, was a major concern to me, I must say, the amount of development. The problem that I've had, though, is once you say, okay, we're gonna eliminate that residential development area, what rationale is provided by the record as I approached it for the number of units that can be allowed in these development zones? And the only real, and I know it's a term that I've become used to through this process, the only metric, I guess, measurement available is by looking at the model of road mortality presented and but yet modified by testimony presented by Audubon, and a recognition that beyond certain traffic volumes, the traffic studies that were done, that there would be a potentially adverse impact on wildlife. in the record, as I understand it, and I stand to be corrected, I mean, Audubon proposed, you know, fairly low traffic volumes beginning to have impacts on smaller animals and things like that. But by the time we got to, 3,000 trips a day, Ken Elo, IF&W, if my recollection serves me correctly, said that that was definitely a sort of a threshold, that a person that was that testified on behalf of Plum Creek regarding lynx habitat said 3,000 seemed to be a good threshold. Seemed to say around 3,000 trips a day will begin to have adverse impacts. If we look at and we take a reasonable view of the competing traffic studies, which I think you've done, and we look at the number of units that are likely to generate the 3,000 and in excess of 3,000 trips a day, you come to the figure of the, what is it here? Where am I? The 284 units. Okay, so it seems to be that it's grounded somehow, at least in the record. Then go on to say, though, that after a certain proportion of the 284 units are actually constructed, there is, in a sense, and I may be using the wrong legal terms here, but there's, in a sense, a rebuttable presumption available to Plum Creek to come in and say, now that we've undertaken this development of X number of units, we can, in terms of the real world, look at those thresholds for adverse wildlife impact. And if they can demonstrate that based on those the actual traffic generated by those units, that no adverse impact or unreasonable adverse impact is affected, then they can increase from the 284 units to a total of, 404. Now, it's this sort of metric machination here that sort of leads us to this, but it is based on the record. Given the fact that some adjacency would apply, I guess, and also recognizing that now we've modified at least one of the resort zones in terms of waterfowl habitat and some restrictions on Burgess Brook, I believe it is. I still have a hard time with this, I have to say. I have a really hard time. But I think eliminating the residential development area and preventing any incursion into what is generally viewed as lynx habitat, in combination with my understanding is, and this is jumping ahead, but I think it's important to talk about it now, shoreline protections, the easement being extended into Spencer Bay, is that not correct? That beyond this development, we would essentially be providing shoreland protection up the east side of the lake, the east shore of the lake, and if not actually adjoining, but coming close to adjoining the publicly reserved land, or other land that is otherwise protected. Is that,
yeah,
am I reading
in terms
that right?
Of, yeah, we can put up the map of the conservation easement areas, but I think you've got the gist of it. There's a 500-foot easement already on the shoreline that is owned by the state. And beyond that 500-foot easement, along Spencer Bay northward to the Days Academy Grant property, public property, would be protected.
My big problem here is this business about the 284 lots and then the possible expansion to 404 lots. I'm having read this stuff, having thought about it as everyone else has, it just, there's something about this that bothers me, and I don't know. I guess I'll leave it at that at this point. But
is it the sheer number 404 that gets you, or is it the concern about what we do when we get to whatever it is, it's a trip point. Is it 135? At 135, you decide whether you can go to 284, and when you get to 284, you decide whether you can go on. Are you concerned about the instability of those points regulatorily?
I think they're the best sort of thresholds that we have, and they're, they're supported in the record.
That's right.
Well, I guess I'm concerned about the overall numbers, but there again, I mean, it's more of a gut thing. When I look at, again, when I look at removing that residential zone and the shoreline protection along Spencer Bay, and a recognition that these two zones are essentially adjacent and could seek approval for development, at what level of concentration I think would be land use based.
I love this this view into your mind, Ed, the your decision making process going on.
Confusing, but I have to say that you wanted a broad overview. That's, and as long as I'm accurate in where, you know, my justification, please correct me if I'm wrong. But then I'd like to hear what other people have to think about this, because I think this is a real. I would also state that to me, what is important here is the connection between the Lily Bay area and the proposed easement. Now, legacy balance, you know, you can call me Tim, you can call me Jim, but what essentially that does is it provides connectivity, easement connectivity, through, well, all the way essentially to Namakana Lake, which is the 100-mile wilderness, not exactly coterminous with the boundaries, but it's essentially the 100-mile wilderness, which, I mean, I think is an astounding legacy. And I think that, I just think that the elimination of that residential zone really enhances that substantially.
Yeah, I think you're getting at some of the real benefits of this plan. And I do think that with the decision points laid out, as long as we understand what happens at those decision points, we're in good shape.
I'll tell you how I rationalize it. And removal of the purple zone there is a huge step towards making this a viable development. I mean, it's a legal lightning rod, that area right there. But it also would alter the traffic studies with the removal of that,
yes,
to the point that most of the activity would take a hard left before it gets to the Lynx Corridor. So you can't throw the studies out the window, but you can certainly look at them with a different outlook, that there will be less cars going north there. And that was a real issue for traveling wildlife. So not to say that some of the residents of that area will turn left and go enjoy that, but I don't think it's going to be what the studies predicted. So that's how I, and plus the fact that is going into the easement. That's right. Yeah, that's not subject to development at the end of 30 years. So I think it's a smart move. It protects everybody legally from what obviously has transpired during the course of these hearings, which, you know, started at one place and ended up in another from the federal standpoint.
Anybody else? Rebecca?
I'm going to sort of move on to different issues that I have that hopefully we can discuss tomorrow. I guess I'd like to have an understanding of the rationale as to why the decision or the recommendation is that resorts could be allowed rather than required. Just your thought process as to how that recommendation came about. I also would like a little more understanding about the affordable housing being part of the cap, and whether or not it makes it likely that affordable housing would even occur if it is part of the cap, and if whether it's something that in your mind seems like a likely place to put it anyway. In my mind, I'm thinking about the affordable housing. I believe one of the studies indicated that what's being proposed is about it's half of what is needed or would be needed. And I'm just, my head's not quite as convoluted as Ed's, but I'm trying to work out in my mind the affordable, not quite, it's approaching that. But sort of in my mind, grapple with the idea of affordable housing, the potential need, and whether or not it would, the likelihood that it would occur here, given that it would be part of the cap. So just sort of an explanation of that. And then I had some questions, which I'm having just some clarification on the no disturbance buffer that's being recommended as opposed to the MNAP, I think it was the MNAP recommendation to remove certain parts from development. And then employee housing needs, just a question. Oh, and back to the affordable housing, sorry to jump back. I have a concern, without knowing a whole lot about affordable housing, that at some point it would no longer be affordable housing, and I guess I just wanted to express that concern that it does, if it does occur, whether it's here or anywhere else, that it would remain truly affordable. It would serve that purpose. And then finally, employee housing needs. How do you determine a need versus a demand? And how that, you know, what metric, I guess, to borrow that term, is used? You know, how do you know when you've got a need, and again, how would that, what insurance is there or assurance is there that those will remain employee housing? So those are just a bunch of questions that I have that hopefully we can thrash around and gain some clarification on.
And just a process question, Chair Harvey. Are those the types of questions that you would like to defer for tomorrow, or should we respond to some of them today?
I guess the deeper we go into this, the more we're committing ourselves to deal with Lily Bay now, not tomorrow. So I guess I don't want to take away from any of the discussion, obviously, but I guess we want to keep, if we want to stick to the plan, we don't want to get too far down the road, because I know Jerry's got a few comments to make about the legal questions that were raised by Ed, and there may be some other comments, but maybe they ought to get those questions on the table. They could give us something to think about tonight,
right,
if that's all right with the commission, rather than...
I think Rebecca's questions are good ones, and I also think that some of them are going to keep coming up over and over. This question of affordable housing and how do you keep it affordable is something that the world is struggling with, but if the staff and consultants have any thought about how we're going to deal with it here, it would be good to know it, because we're going to see it over and over again as we go through this today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something we can respond to pretty quickly right now, if that's all right.
Okay. Who's the affordable housing expert, if there is such a person in the world?
That would be Ron, actually.
That's Ron. Oh.
That would not be Ron. Ron will provide you with my knowledge based on the record that does not go beyond that. Commissioner Kurtz, I think I understand the questions you're asking. Let's first identify, and it sounds like you understand, but just to make sure we're on the same page, the two types of employee or indirect employee housing needs that are provided for or proposed by Plum Creek in the plan, and then what staff recommendations are. And I'm following the chair and Og, and I'm going to talk generically here, okay? Employee housing is used by Plum Creek as a term of art, a defined term. And it refers to, and we interpret it as meaning, housing for short-term or seasonal employees. Principally at the resorts. So to the extent that there is a summer season and my son decides that he needs to be gainfully employed and wants to go up to the Moosehead region and Plum Creek or who's ever running the resort offers him a job and there's no place to stay, their proposed zone for the resorts created employee housing as an allowable use. That's what it said, okay? Number one, employee housing is a term of art that's thought of for short-term seasonal employees. it was related to the resort zone, and Plum Creek had it as an allowable use. What staff consultants are recommending for this category, employee housing, is that as part of the long-term development plan for the resorts, Plum Creek make a showing in the proposed plan that the commission would have to approve that either they are prepared to meet these employee housing needs, we didn't specify on-site versus off-site, or that there's no need to meet them because there's sufficient short-term employee housing for my son in Greenville or whatever. Okay, so that's how they have proposed, and where we've, I think, moved it a little further towards a specific requirement vis-a-vis the resorts. Affordable housing is a term used by Plum Creek in a different way, as we understand it. Affordable housing, in our minds, is that type of housing that might be provided for employees of a construction firm, for instance, who have ongoing house construction in the area and need a place for them and their family on a permanent or semi-permanent basis that they can afford, or whatever other secondary jobs might be created such that people, you know, at a gift shop in Greenville that opens up as a result. Our view of the record evidence, going back to your statement on affordable housing, is as follows. First of all, Plum Creek has proposed the following, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, and I'll invite Og and Evan to jump in. They entered into an arrangement with Coastal Enterprises in which, it's a two-phase arrangement. The first phase, which has already occurred, and is not contingent on plan approval, had a subsidized loan going to Coastal Enterprises. I think the amount was $800,000 or $900,000. It's in my notes. I can look at that way. And the grant of 25 acres of land, the record suggests it would be in the Greenville area, to address existing affordable housing needs. The second part of their proposed financial proposal for affordable housing was that upon plan approval, there would be an additional grant of approximately the same amount of a subsidized loan. So I think the total in total was $1.7 million. And a grant of, I believe, 100 acres of land, 75 acres, it's a total of 100 acres, I'm sorry, I misspoke, a total of 75 acres of land in specified development zones, or not in specified, but in development zones where under their proposal, affordable housing was an allowable use, where the specific location would be determined, but that's where the 75 acres was. Then from a zoning perspective, what they were proposing or are proposing, as I just mentioned, is in specific zones, not all the zones, but in certain specified zones, affordable housing is a permitted use. What staff is recommending, and this is on page 117 of your recommendations. What staff consultants are recommending vis-a-vis affordable housing on the right-hand side is, first of all, that you allow, subject to plan approval, the second phase of the Coastal Enterprises arrangement. That's the 75 acres in the second part of the subsidized loan, Commissioner White. That you open up where affordable housing is a permitted use to everything that's every place that has the new residential zone that we're proposing. But you're not requiring it any place. You're allowing it every place where that residential zoning is. I've already spoken about the requirement of the demonstration of adequacy of employee housing, and we can go to the specific text. And then, as part of our proposal to, I would say, disaggregate or break into three pieces the proposed community stewardship fund, one of the funds would be an affordable housing fund. And I can explain now or when we get to it the basis of that recommendation. But the idea, and it goes to the point that you mentioned, Commissioner, is that our view of the record evidence from both the Maine State Housing Authority and from both Piscataquis and Somerset County was there was an existing serious affordable housing problem in Greenville and in the counties, and that additional subsidies, in addition to what Plum Creek was proposing, would be necessary under a full build-out projection. But the Maine State Housing Authority was also very quick to note that it was simply a projection, and that they thought the idea of an ongoing fund that could address reality when the needs presented themselves was their very strong recommendation, rather than some kind of formula that was based on things that might change. So that's the, going to Commissioner White's request, that's the broad approach to affordable and employee housing, and I suppose how that relates to Lily Bay we can get to when the chair wants to go into it in depth.